want to just mention this, and I'll call it a privilege, because Sister Mary was visiting San Francisco in May of this year to our feast day at St. Nicholas Church. And I asked her how her plan was as far as going to the monastery, or to the pilgrimage that she was telling me about. And she said, oh, you know, it's fine, but we don't have a translator. And I said, I'm already going to be in Moscow for 2 months, or in Russia. And I said, well, gee, maybe I can offer some help. So she emailed to, his name is Fred, and he was organizing this trip, and we met in Santa Rosa, and he said, this is fantastic, you can be our translator, and I'll pay your road and your room and board. And I was like, whoa, great, thank you. And little did I realize that I have never translated in my whole life. I know Russian well enough to get along just fine, but when I start to think of certain words and how to translate it, it's like, oh my gosh, how in the world is that word in English, or vice versa. So I had many sleepless nights, but I thought, well, this is going to be an adventure, and it'll be a pilgrimage, and it'll be, you know, I had no idea who would be on this trip except Fred, who I met, and Sister Mary. So we met in Moscow, and it was just six of us total. So this was probably a gift, you know, to have been given to us, that we would have such a small group and have such a, you know, a unique opportunity that a large group may not. Of course, Fred didn't organize very much very early on, so we came places, but again, that Russian hospitality, nobody even was like, well, what, we didn't know you were coming. Oh, well, I guess you better just go stay in the local hotel. No, this Matushka, we would call her in Russian, but she's not a nun. She has like a guest house that have the nuns and the guest of the priest in the local town. And so this, we are now way up on top of this map, a little tiny dot on the White Sea. And so this is Kim. And this is Kim. So we're in this little town, and it's 24 hours by train from Moscow. So I met with them the evening before, and then that night we got on a train at 1 a.m. and sat on that train for 24 hours. Arrived to this town.
Why is there a special there?
This is the Solovki Monastery. Uh-huh. So this was the first stop on Sister Mary's and this pilgrimage that this man Fred organized. And so this bus just has on the front Polomniki, which is pilgrims. From all over Russia, people come here as a starting point. This is about 6 in the morning, and we're getting ready to board this little ferry. So this is a whole group of people that have come. Off to the bottom are all their bags of food that they'll, you know, take with them. And so we started out on this little ferry boat filled to the brim with maybe 60 people, I can't remember what. And 2.5 hours later, within view comes the monastery of Solovki.
Who was the saint on the boat?
That was Saint
Nicholas.
No, it's a different one. Probably Saint Philip. That's going to be an educated guess, because I remember there was one that was Philip and another one that was somebody else. I'm sorry, I've forgotten exactly who that is.
It's White Sea, right?
This is the White Sea. So this was, we spent 2.5 hours going, as you can see from that map, there's a city called Kim, and then there's the little dot where there's a little island. Well, that took 2.5 hours to get that far, and a fairly slow ferry. This is not a, you know, a very fast moving little ship. So this is Solovki. Ever since I had started going to the Orthodox Church, had heard about this monastery, and I did read a little bit about it. This was founded in 1420s by Saint Savati, who wanted to be away from everybody. So this is remote. This is very remote. He sailed here on a little rowboat. Well, he didn't sail. He had a little rowboat. And so he made his way from probably more like Arkhangelsk, which is another kind of on that side. And he was originally from the St. Kirill and Belozersk Monastery in southern, a little bit more southern, definitely southern from this. And then he was joined by St. Herman. In the 1430s, his health wasn't very good, so St. Sabathi went back to the mainland. He died there, but Father Herman met Father Zosima. Now, this is, I have it written down, otherwise I could not do this by memory, because I keep getting it mixed up. But anyways, he told him about this island and said, let's go, let's found, you know, let's establish a monastery. So they returned there and actually established a very formal monastery. And they began to attract other aesthetics. I mean, this is the early period where, you know, the monastic life is, you know, beginning. And their very first church here, which is no longer there, was the Church of the Transfiguration. And it was a wooden church. They started, I'm not remembering how many came at that time, but over a number of years, there were probably up to 100, 200 monks, definitely over the course of, say, you know, 70, 80 years. But they had salt here, they had fishing, they had trapping, they had a lot of things to keep them going. And so in 1478, St. Sosima dies, and then shortly thereafter, St. Herman. And so then in the sort of the 1500s, St. Philip, and this is why I think that icon was St. Philip, that's where I pulled that out of my head, he did a lot of building. And so a lot of the buildings that we saw there on this monastery are from his time. And these are incredible to see, the size, the immensity, and they're all brick and stone. He later became very famous as one of the metropolitans of Moscow, St. Philip. And he had very close connections, as you know from Russian history, the Tsar and the church had very close connections. And Metropolitan Philip ended up being exiled back here.
Of course.
So this monastery, because of its remoteness and harsh life, was definitely used as a prison, even in way back. I mean, this is 1500s. And then they built this huge fortress, and we'll see another part of it a little bit later. Because then in the late 1500s, you have the Germans and the Finns and the Swedes, they're all trying to come from way over here in the left part of this map into the White Sea to conquer Russia. Mm-hmm. So this is, you know, like many of the monasteries, this was our welcoming kids. This is the entrance, one of the entrances into the monastery. And so this became a fortress and a monastery at the same time. Well, it's an island, and I don't know if Sister Mary remembers how big this island is. It's not huge. It's enough to rent a bike and go from one end to the other. So maybe 10 miles one way, 10 miles the other way.
No population.
No, there's a lot of population. Thank you for reminding me of that. Because what happened during the Soviet, well, let me go back just a little bit. So by 1600s, in the middle, there are probably about 300 monks by this time, and 600 plus workers, you know, lay people who come to help out. There was, you know, a lot of battles, you know, that happened with the Swedes at that time, but we won't go into that part. In the late sort of 1600s, you now have, he was Patriarch Nikon, who began a lot of reforms. And also Peter the Great started taking away a lot of monastic territory from monasteries, saw that how flourishing they were and how rich they were, economically rich, that he, you know, began to abscond with their land also. But at the time,
they still bring the bells?
These bells are not rung because they're too heavy for that particular area. I think with time they'll be able to build, they have to build a regular whole bell tower. This bell is huge. It's about the size, if a person can stand next to that, and they're not even to the top of it. And so this monastery became rather famous during that time because you had like the old believers, for lack of, you know, very distinctive groups. When Nikon started his reforms, you had some groups that absolutely did not want to go with his reforms. And so now we call them mostly old believers, lots of different sects. And many of these monks did not go with the reforms. And so they... and then, you know, time goes on, that it more or less stayed as a monastery until 1921. Soviets closed it, but again, because it was so isolated, they designated this monastery as one of the gulags, one of the prison camps. And it had a very special designation, as it was called Sloan. And the translation would be roughly like a prison camp for a designated reason. And so every prisoner
political,
that came
political,
here, political, but also lots and lots of monastics and priests were sent here. So this was almost entirely religious persecution. And
it was one of the most severe ones.
And it was severe. I mean, the life on there at that point, that, you know, it was in disrepair. This is our tour guide. I have to say I got off very, very easy as being a translator because this woman knew English absolutely 100% perfect. The only word she wanted to know from me was prepodobni. Now, I was very hard put to try to figure that one out for her, and I to this day have to at least email her and say, I still don't know.
Venerable.
But it's venerable.
Venerable.
But in Russian, there's still a different sense of what the meaning is. And this woman, I mean, she's a very good, I think, for me, example, a story of... she's probably in her 40s, I think, early 40s, and, you know, grew up in mostly Soviet times, half and half, was a nuclear scientist. She learned her English in San Diego. She was there as an exchange scientist. And I asked her how it was she came here, because she's in charge of all the pilgrims on this monastery. And she said at one point, 7-8 years ago, she decided that her spiritual life needed work. And so she gave up everything. Her whole, you know, life as a scientist, came here to this monastery to work. She goes back to Moscow usually during the winter. The winter time here is very stark and cold
and
rough. So nobody probably comes here much during the winter time. And this is just, you'll see a couple of the little churches. This is kind of one of the walls. You can't quite get the depth. This is inside the main Transfiguration. And there was a family in Arkhangelsk who gave all the money to build that iconostasis, not to restore it. I mean, that's brand new. This is, they're getting ready for a procession. Every Sunday they have a procession that goes out. And it comes all the way around the walls and all the way down. And, you know, the monastery itself is rather small. And the island does not belong to the monastery. So this is very different than some of the other monasteries. It had before. It was only monastery and lay workers. There's probably about 1,000 people who live here, mostly having their livelihood from the tourists, the pilgrims, and groups that, you know, come and study nature there. I mean, it's a beautiful, beautiful area. This is the abbot of the monastery, who is also the director of the museum for the monastery. So, you know, it's kind of a unique partnership. This priest on the left was sort of the policing of the people in church, make sure the men stood on this side and the women on that side. This was the procession coming back in, and there was definitely one that didn't want his picture taken, and the next one maybe not that happy. This is Father Herman, and he is one of the, I'm not sure that I would refer to him as one of the elders, but he was one of the first five that came to this monastery in 1990 when it was given back to the church. And we had the privilege of meeting with him for an evening for a couple hours to ask questions, and he told about his life and sort of some of the changes he sees with young monks who now all have computers, all have cell phones, and the difference of life that he has experienced.
How many monks are there?
There's 30, 40?
Yeah, 45.
Not too many. They're, you know, it's still, and it may be because, you know, they are not financially well off. I mean, this is...
Well, we get money.
Well, the money that, like, we came, we stayed in a hotel, and that money goes to people running the hotel. So, you know, they depend on donations.